Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is early Apple podcaster Victor Cajiao. Victor, welcome.
Hey, John. How are you?
I am good. How are you?
Wonderful. It's a pleasure to be on mic with you and meet virtually, if you will.
Yeah, because I have heard your name and known about you for years and years and seen you on Mac stock videos and seen you play music and heard about you, and you are almost legendary in the Apple community, and it's a pleasure to meet you. I don't know how I avoided, not avoided, how I just didn't ever come across your path before, but it's a pleasure to meet you now.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And yeah, quite active for about 6 years. I was like in all over the interwebs.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that in the second half of the show. But as usual, in background mode, we go a little bit into the background of the guest. You are notable for having been born in Havana, Cuba, grew up in the U.S., worked for AT&T, became well-known in the Apple world with several podcasts, and you're currently a musician and hobby photographer and retiree and traveler.
That's all correct, yes.
I nailed it.
You nailed it the first time.
You helped me out a little bit. So I'm curious about having been born in Havana. How did your family come to the U.S.?
You know, we were quite fortunate. We were part of a refugee program, if you will, that Kennedy had put together and allowing people like us to be admitted into the U.S. And my uncle, who was already in the U.S., he came out here right before Castro, right as Castro took over. He was smart enough to get the heck out of Dodge. And so he petitioned for us, paid a bunch of money. I think it was $20,000 for my grandma, sister, mom, and I, which was a pretty big amount of money in 68. And so we got to come over here, Christmas Eve, 1968. And
wasn't that the Apollo 8 moon orbit?
Yeah, I believe it might have been the Apollo 8.
That's when astronaut Borman read from the Bible as they were circling the backside of the moon.
That's right, where they read the famous reading from the Bible. I think that was that. Yeah, that's when that happened. Of course, I would not have been aware of that, but trust me, we were praying about a famous reading from the Bible too. And it was amazing getting to come to the U.S. that day. Now, you have to remember or realize that I was a kid who had grown up in a communist system. You know, we were little pioneers and had to wear uniforms and had to learn how to take apart rifles at 7 years of age. That was part of our education. And so that was my... when I went to school and then when I went home, we knew that we were gusanos, worms. We were people who were not wanted to be there, had petitioned to get out. And so there was this weird dichotomy of living there, even as a child, where you were hated because you were a deserter, you wanted to leave, but you knew that that was your path to freedom. So you waited for that day where that motorcycle cop was going to show up at your house to quarantine it and get you out and not ever let you take another possession. So you waited for that day. It was a bittersweet thing. And one day, you know, it finally happened. We had gotten out what we could. And that day came, and it was like within 6 months, maybe a little longer, we were gone. Now, mom and grandma had to go do hard labor every day
was
for
6 months.
Was
there resistance in Havana, to active resistance to try to prevent you, or did the government sort of cooperate with Kennedy's program?
No, the government was cooperating, but they were going to make your life miserable until the day you left. In the form of, for my mom and grandma, again, they went to hard labor camps every day. We would all wake up as a family at 3 a.m, get on a bus, go out to the farms. Mom and grandma would work the farms all day while my sister and I went to school. And this happened for, oh gosh, I don't even know exactly how long, but a long time. And that was one of the prices of being a worm, a gusano. So finally the day came, 24th of December, and we left out a Varadero passport, and that was a whole trip. I actually had a podcast called Immigration Tales at one point where I actually tell this story in about a 2-hour episode. So I'm giving you a very condensed version.
How old were you when you came?
I was nine. Yeah. And it was, I saw some terrible things getting out. The family and just ahead of us had a boy who was mentally challenged. And the, when you were leaving Cuba, you have the Cuban government agents. And then the next people you talk to are Swiss because they were a neutral party. And then a U.S. representative to get you on the plane. Well, this family was about to leave. The boy was mentally handicapped. He was asked to spell his last name. Now, mom and sister had crossed the threshold into the Swiss territory. Dad and son had not. Government asked him to spell his name. The kid couldn't. And that family was separated before my very eyes. They said, "You're staying. And, you know, mom and daughter need to go." So that was like the next people just ahead of me in queue. So you can imagine as a 9-year-old boy, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm about to be separated from my family.
But you made it.
But we made it. We made it. I was able to spell my name. No problem.
And well, that's good because some of us can't.
yeah. Most of you can't. Trust me. So then getting to America was awesome that day because as soon as we arrive, we go through an immigration thing and it's basically the day before Christmas and we're being given everything because it's the day before Christmas, which we don't know anything about. But here are some presents, blah, blah, blah. You know, and to me, this was the land of wonderment. I mean, that was the kid who actually thought that in America, they had a bottle of Coke that when you opened it, it turned cold. And I thought, yeah, that place is cool, and, you know, which I think is an awesome idea, by the way. Somebody should do it. So, yeah, so we made it. Here we were. You know, we landed there. We were in Miami for 4 days before we were flown to California. You know, government paid. Imagine that back in the day when immigrants were greeted and embraced as a part of the American dream.
Yeah.
You know, what a day. What happened to that? So you can imagine I have some very passionate feelings around immigration and around the wonderfulness that is America that's made out of this great salad bowl of people, you know. So there you go. So that's how I got here to the U.S. And I was one of those guys that, and I am very proud to be here, very proud of my government, very proud to have become an American citizen.
And proud to make strong contributions to the United States, too.
And you had to. That was the requirement. That's what my mom and grandma said. You have to make a contribution because you owe a great debt. And to this day, that is still true.
Yes. So as a youth, there must have come a time, I'm guessing, when you fell into computers at some point. Or did that happen much, much later?
No, it happened. I guess it happened later in comparatively today. It would have been Commodore 64, I believe. No, I'm sorry. Radio Shack TRS-80 was my first.
Oh, I've heard this story before.
Yeah, that was my first one.
And those companies only knew the influence they had on youth. I mean, like every guest says it was an Apple II or a Commodore 64 or a TRS-80 that launched them on their career path. For me, it was an Apple II.
Yeah. So I was always into that. And I was even always into broadcasting. I as a 6-year-old, there was a radio station across the street.
You got to tell me that story.
Oh, sure. This is a good story. As a 6-year-old, there's a radio station across the street. And every day they have a kid show, you know, like just they have it's kid stories and kid related things.
Nice, age six,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And I knew that they broadcast from there. And one day I just walked in because that's the kind of kid I was. And I said, you know, Mr. So-and-so, I want to be on the radio. And of course, this little cute kid walking in and the guy puts me on the radio and
bold.
And the next thing you know, I'm like a regular on this show, you know, like once a week he has me in and we have to do a little shtick. I have no idea what the shtick is, but I was even a ham then. And so that was my first broadcasting experience. And then I continued my geekiness in broadcasting in that when I was about 14, I was suffering some kind of, it wasn't epilepsy, but they thought it was. And so I had to stay home the summer of 1972, the Olympics. And my mom was trying to learn English.
Berlin, right?
Yeah. Mom was trying to learn English with an old machine that had a cassette deck and a record player and all of the records that had the lessons. Well, I would take the cassette deck and put a microphone to it and record myself doing play-by-play to the Olympics and then listening back to my own tapes.
Oh, the little podcaster starts his career.
So that's I don't think great. I've ever told that story online, but yeah, I did that.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. So did you make it to college?
I didn't make it to college until after I started working, and we can talk about that, but they gave me the opportunity at 30 to get that degree that I had not gotten, because I got, you know, I got wrapped up in a bunch of things tried to go to junior college, but I just wasn't really striving. I thought I wanted to be a professional musician, but I didn't have the discipline at 18, 19 to really pull it off. And so I started just working. I started working at a pawn shop, of all things. Oh, my goodness. That was a life experience. You know, I think it was, what year was that? Well, it was up to 1989. I worked there about 10 years. And I learned a lot of great things, but I also lost a lot of my humanity through that experience that I had to, you know, come back and really make amends for later, because it was it sucked the soul out of me. You know, I became a user of people instead of a contributor. And so that was it was a negative experience in that way, but it was a positive experience is that it taught me a lot about the difference between street life and the life that we normally all live. And it created a balance in me that was important later in my career. Let's put it that way.
Did that play a role in you getting the first job with AT&T in a good way?
It played a fantastic role. I lost my job January 1st of 1989, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I wasn't trained to do anything else. I was a really good salesman. I was a really good con man, if you will. I don't mean that in a traditional sense that I was grifting in the streets, but that I knew how to talk to people in or out of anything and sell them in or out of anything to buy something from them or to sell them something. But that turned into, okay, I'm lost. What do I do now? But I had this work ethic that I had been given as a little boy that had not gone away. And so I picked up the phone and I called 411 and I asked the operator, how did you get your job?
Bold.
Yep.
I'm seeing a theme here.
The theme's there. And she told me, and I went to that office and I got a job as a 411 operator 22 days after I lost my original job.
That's a cool story.
Well, it gets a little better, actually. Walked in, started training me and as a 411 operator, one of the things you really have to be good at is spelling, because people are just, you know, giving you what they need, right?
Sure.
So I'm in a training environment. I'm in a union shop, but I don't even know what that really means. And they're trying to train me and pass me through a course that takes about a week. About 4 days into the course, I failed the course because of my lack of being able to spell well. And I'm just crushed. And I'm dismissed from AT&T. Bye. And I really wanted this job. I didn't know at the time I could have contacted a union rep. I could have gotten representation. I was just, and they didn't tell me either, by the way. And so I walk off and I go home and I'm devastated. But I had met a contact at the hiring office, the HR person. Her and I really got along well. And I called her back and I said, this is what happened, but I really want to work for this company. I will do anything if you have some other type of job. And she said, you know, we have another job as a zero operator. Would you like to try that? I'm like, yep. And so I tried that and it was easy. That one I got no problem because it involved a lot more talking. We even did marine operator at the time. As a matter of fact, when the Valdez was coming home from Alaska and making phone calls to the home office, they were going through me as an operator because we had to put timestamps on when the call started and ending. And I had to every 15 seconds go into the call and monitor to see if they were done. And so anyways, it was a great job. And within 6 months of that, I was a operator supervisor. And then within, a year and a half, I was hired as a first level manager for operator services, you know. And then to wrap it all around, within 4 years, I was a second level manager transferred to the original office of the directory assistance where I had been fired from, and the person who fired me worked for me.
Oh, how sweet.
But they never knew. They never knew that I never said anything to them. Now, I used it when I was a manager for a lot of training classes. While I was doing training, people that were failing, I would tell them this story and say, you have an opportunity here. You know, you can pick it up. So anyways.
I don't know if you could ever do that this day and age.
I don't know either. That's
something from the past.
But it made for a great retirement story.
Yeah. The ability to sell yourself is a key virtue and strength these days, no matter who you're working for and what the year is. Believing in yourself and selling yourself is really a good thing to do.
And tenacity. I think it's just such an important trait that we have tenacity at whatever we do and that we just don't give up. It's that, you know, get up off that horse and get back on and, go forward. Yeah. That really pays off in so many ways. And to this day is something that I try to practice, tenacity.
These are fantastic stories, but we've run out of time in the first segment. So it's time to take a short commercial break. Folks, I'm chatting with Victor Cajillo. And so we'll be back in 60 seconds and we'll pick up and we'll talk about your life at AT&T and podcasting. How's that?
Sounds great.
Folks, we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with Victor Cajillo. So I'm intrigued by your life at AT&T. I've never talked to somebody who's been an AT&T employee in management. There came a time when you got involved in what was called the E911 project. Tell me about that. What is E911? Can you explain that and what you did?
Yeah, I can do that. My career at AT&T involved several companies, Pacific Bell, which was a local phone company. They were purchased then in about 96, I think, by SBC Incorporated. And then SBC bought AT&T. So I eventually became an AT&T employee. And it was an incredible difference in culture. Pacific Bell was almost like working for a mom and pop, even though they were 70, 80,000 employees in California. To the time I left AT&T, oh my gosh, millions and millions of people. And the cultures were so different. Some of it good, some of it bad. E911 was the second job before I left the company. And I was a manager of developers that would make and manage the database for the emergency 911 contract for the state of California. State of California has contracted AT&T to run that so that when you dial 911 from your home phone, no matter who your carrier is, then that call, and remember that in California, at least at the time, for your home phone, your carrier had to be AT&T because Verizon and AT&T were separated by the FCC at that time. So, but we'll leave that aside. But when you picked up that phone, you dialed 911, then the call would come into our telephone switch. It would go into then our database and do a dip into the data for your record. Your record would then be sent to the appropriate PSAP, which was the appropriate police or fire station for your location. Now, here we're talking about location, not as in GPS, because not that advanced. We're talking about an early 80s system. We're talking about location based upon a database that is fed by geographic mapping location, but done by hand. Major thoroughfares
was
very antiquated from a street address. Right. Yeah. And so then it gets routed to the right police or fire department so that they can help you And of course, that kind of service has to have, you know, 100%, 99 plus six nines reliability, because people die. And one of the things that was really great about being in that position in IT was that when it came for me to need budget because I needed new hardware, or I needed to do a software upgrade, or I needed to even hire people, it was much simpler than other departments, because I would sit in a meeting asking for $2 or $3 million. Someone said no, and I simply said, you know, make sure I get your name so I know who to have film at 11 call.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to call me. And magically, the budget would be approved. Because I'm like, we're talking about lives here. This is not the place that is a profit center for AT&T. This is the place that we give back. And so that was a message that had to be, you know, put out there. So it was a great job that way. It was a wonderful job, very fulfilling. One of many jobs, mostly in IT. I started in operating services, like I said, as a manager, moved to IT in the mid-90s, and grew up in IT doing call center automation type stuff. And I put the first ATM switch between California and St. Louis so that the call centers could work together. And people were like, this can't be done. I'm like, yeah, I can, because ATM was brand new. So I didn't know what I didn't know, and that really served me well on that project. And so what we did was basically we took the SS7, which is the signaling part of the call that says, somebody's calling you, and this is who it is, and you need to make your phone ring. Well, all of that normally comes through cables through the telephone companies, and they get interexchanged through long distance. Well, we wanted to not pay for long distance because it was intercompany. And so I just put that signaling path through what now we would call an IP to IP connection, you know, but using ATM. So I segregated that part of the traffic from the switch, and we had them engineer that into that. And then the traditional call, the voice part of the call, then what we did is we put end-to-end T1s between the two offices, and therefore bypassing long-distance companies, because it was legal to do that at that point for us. It was intercompany. And the cost of the call went from 5 cents a minute to 1/10 of a cent per minute. So it was a huge success. Cool. But it came with cool, interesting barriers. Things like, I didn't recognize that after you cross the Mississippi, you get a 1/8 of a second echo, which is not tolerable to humans. And so the first time we made the call, that was not a problem, but the echo was intolerable. So we had to put echo cancelers at each end to compensate for that. It was really an interesting project. So those are the kind of things that I worked for then. Then I took over the IT tools team. We would build all of the internet web tools, password authentication type tools. I had 40 developers working for me. I can't code myself out of a bag, but I know how to code, how to manage developers. You know, I knew how to make them work proficiently by letting them do their thing. Hey, Vic, we want to work with the lights dimmed. Go ahead. Hey, Vic, I really do best between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. Go ahead. As long as your output is what it's supposed to be. I use the method from an old movie I saw with a racer and a mirror. Nobody needs a back mirror when you're racing. You just rip it off and say what's behind me is of no importance. You know, so there you go.
I'm guessing you were a PC-oriented company, and this is where your first introduction to PC and podcasting started with
typical
PC user?
We were definitely. I had been a PC user ever since I started using Commodores, and yes, typical PC user came out of me listening to some podcasts. I think Adam Christensen was one of the first ones in the Mac world, and so then I looked up what was happening in the PC world, and I thought, well, I don't really see too much out there yet. This is April of 2005. And
the dawn, really almost the dawn.
And I had a mixer and I had a microphone, and I knew enough about to figure out RSS, because we had to almost code it by hand then. And I'm like, I can do this. And so I started the typical PC user. And at first I had 40 listeners, and then I had 400. And then December of that same year, my wife bought a Mac Mini and switched over. And after playing with that, not even 10 days, I'm like, oh, I'm going to start typical Mac user with the premise of the new guy who just opened the computer. And how do I get from that guy and my discoveries to being eventually a guy who can teach others about Macintosh and the Mac world?
Now, you glossed over that pretty fast there, that you just fell in love with your wife's Mac Mini and just became so enamored with Mac OS that it was like an eye-opener. Is that how it went?
It was a total eye-opener because my background as a musician, I didn't have out of a computer what I have when I go into my toolbox and I grab a Phillips screwdriver, which is the right tool for the job I'm doing. I never got that warm and fuzzy with PCs. But when I switched to the Mac and I started using applications like GarageBand, it was like I had come home from a workflow perspective.
Okay.
My workflow, all of a sudden, the computer was serving me. I wasn't serving it. And that was a wake-up moment for me. It was really cathartic for me to have that. And of course, then I wanted just to share that with people, and in podcasting, being able to share something in real time, the good, the bad, the ugly, didn't edit myself really from that perspective. That opened itself up to a lot of things, you know. And then I started interviewing people. Gosh, I remember Christmas of 96, Christmas Day, I shoot off an email to Amber Mac. I know you know who Amber is. And I said, you don't know me from Adam, but it's Christmas and you probably are going to read this first thing tomorrow. I'd love to interview you for the show. And she didn't know me from anything. And I was a pretty small show, but she said, yes. She said, wow, that was pretty gutsy to, you know, email somebody Christmas Day.
All you have to do is say no.
Well, I learned that from Mom. Mom always said, ask the prettiest girl to dance.
Yeah.
Because all they can do is say no. I've always asked the prettiest girl to dance in every facet of my life.
Did you start the Mac Roundtable with Adam about that time?
No, Adam, they started that on their own. Tim Verporten and Adam and those guys had started that. Adam had me on several times, which was a thrill for me because to me, Adam is the pioneer. Adam is the most, for me, the most authentic, personable person in podcasting in the Mac world, because it's just Adam. You're like,
he's our webmaster, you know.
I know he is, but it's like going and having a beer with somebody. It's just somebody that you're just hanging with, and he doesn't care what stance you are, if you're the new guy or somebody that's much more knowledgeable than he is. You're still the same thing, and so he would have me on and we would do things like talk about Macintosh history. And he would teach me about, you know, some of the things that happened with the earlier computers. And it was very, so he would have me on here and there. And then I just, you know how it was by that time, the community was getting more tight. And I guess I had done a good enough job that I hadn't stepped on any toes. And I was graciously kind of admitted into that fold. Don McAllister and I became friends very quickly because we almost started at the same time. And before you knew it, that little circle of friends, you know, had grown.
I've had Don McAllister and Adam Christensen on Background Mode, and they were delightful.
Yeah, great people. Great people.
Yes. So there came a time when you decided to suspend the podcast. Is that about when you retired from AT&T?
No, it was much earlier. It was 2011, and I was having some health problems. Actually, in 2008, I had a bit of a health problem with my heart, and it was the doctors just told me, this is too stressful for you, and I had put a pressure on myself that, looking back at it today, was just unreasonable. You know, I was that guy who was counting listeners. I was that guy, you know, I was selling my own ads. I was making some revenue and I wanted to grow. And I just wasn't mature enough in this space to recognize what really was valuable. So I got too wrapped up in it. And the doctor was like, you're doing yourself more harm than good. You know, and some other things happened to me around alcohol abuse, for example, and I, you know, got sober and all of that. And so it was like, I got to get my priorities straight. And so it was time to kind of put it away. And then from 11 to 14, I wasn't on the internet at all publicly. You know, not one iota. I just wasn't out.
But still with AT&T.
Still with AT&T. My job was important. I needed to keep doing that. And so at 14, I came back into Twitter and kind of just felt my way around. A couple of people had me on their podcast. And then in 2015, actually late 14, AT&T had one of those early buyout things, you know, that come right around Christmas time.
Those can be really sweet.
It can be really sweet and it can really be bittersweet for some people, you know. But for me, it was the right offer at the right time. I had done 26 years of really good work with them. I had started very young. They had paid for my education. Getting back to that, I went back to college in 91. They paid for a private college and got my degree thanks to them. And that's what propelled me into my middle management career. So, you know, from very positive feelings. And it was like, okay, you know, I can do this. I can have a pension for the rest of my life. And it's time to kind of just hang that up and see what's next. I wanted to just to rest for a while, to be honest. And that's what I did in April of 2015. I retired and continued on being retired and started encouraging my wife, who was a teacher, to retire, to say, look, I'm doing it. We're not going hungry yet. It's time for you as well.
What took you from California to South Dakota?
Well, my wife is from North Dakota, and we were dealing, California is a wonderful place, but it's very expensive to be a retiree. And after doing some research, Mary has a sister here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and her other sibs are in North Dakota. And unfortunately, the what happened that made her retire was her sister got very ill with a blood disease that was being taken care of at the Mayo Clinic. And Mary was the only match for a stem cell donor to try to save her sister's life. And this was November of 16. And it was a moment for Mary where she finally woke up and said, I got to go. I got to go take care of my sister. So we did that in January of 17. We went and did the transplant, and it was very successful, unfortunately, until it wasn't. Oh. Well, until it wasn't. And her sister did end up passing away. But through that November, and then we came out here April of 17, we said, it's time to move. And we put the house up for sale. My wife, unbeknownst to me, had been doing a bunch of research on Airstream trailers. You know Airstreams, right? The ones that the NASA used with the astronauts?
Isn't there a big Airstream congregation every year in Las Cruces, New Mexico?
There is. There is that one. I think it's called Airpalooza or something like that. Don't quote me. But she had fell in love with these things and was watching YouTubes, and she said, let's go check them out. Well, long story short, we bought one. We bought a truck for it. We sold our other two cars and became a one-car family. We did a huge purge of stuff from 20 years at our old house, sold the house, and moved out here to South Dakota, where I literally live in a town of 700 people. Surrounded by cornfields and soybeans, and completely different lifestyle.
Oh, yeah. And I'm in Colorado, and I think of Colorado as being possibly some more wintry than New Mexico, where I spent some time. What's the winter weather like in South Dakota? I'm curious.
Well, last winter, because we had the Airstream, part of the plan was, well, winter in the West, where mom still lives and sister in California and Vegas, where my son is. And we did that. Last year, we did that. We left day after Thanksgiving and came back about the 10th of April thinking we're good. Well, huge blizzard happened like 2 days after we got here. So yeah. I definitely got to see a really bad blizzard. And there was some snowfall before we left, too.
Careful visiting Colorado, because if you're up in the Rockies, and even in the summertime, you can have a storm come through. And it can snow in June and July above 10,000 feet. So you have to be careful.
Exactly. So this year, we're staying here for the winter. We're going to stay here. And I'll get the full brunt force of it. As a matter of fact, just the other day, I took my lawnmower apart and put the snowblower attachment to it just to make sure I could do it. So that'll be interesting from a Cuban California boy. And just everything here is so different. Just the life here is just a different pace. And it is middle America. And I have to contend with most people being politically not in alignment with me. That's a challenge.
And you have Skype in a town of 700.
I have gigabit Ethernet in a town of 700.
Very nice.
Yeah, I wasn't going to give that up. Believe me, I didn't switch on that.
I'm envious. Gigabit Ethernet. Wow. Optical fiber into your house?
Optical fiber into the alley right behind my house, yes. So
an AT&T guy would know all about this.
Oh, yeah. Pretty important to me. So it's neat. It's 20 miles away is Brookings, which is a college town. And so, you know, I get everything that comes along with a college town vibe and feel, and a little more politically centrist than the rest of the folks that I meet. And it's a wonderful challenge for me because it makes me be a part of, despite of our differences or whatever, how can I be a contributor to the community? How can I be a South Dakotan, putting aside political differences, for example? And so that's a challenge,
sure.
You know, but it's one that I'm willing to step up to. I love it out here. I love getting in the car, getting on the freeway and having no traffic, none. It's glorious. Speed limit's 80 out here. So we're enjoying our retired life. We've learned some things in the winter when we were away. One of the biggest things, if you guys are going to retire, my goodness, you really have to know about data. At one point, we had AT&T and Verizon, a MiFi, and a regular connection. And so you really have to do your research there because you're not going – when you're a geek like me on the road, no matter what you do, you're going to run out of data and – you know, you'll have to do things like read, which I can do.
Well, that's a great story. We have run out of time, but I want to thank you for telling me this fabulous career story, all starting in Havana and going through AT&T and your life as a podcaster and now Airstream life. This has been a wonderful story. One of the reasons we do background mode is to hear the career arc of people as an inspiration. Who did you meet? How did you do it? How did you sell yourself? What were the events in your life that led to the next step in your career? And you've just kind of just spelled that all out for us in a wonderful way. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I hope I wasn't too much of a chatty Cathy for you.
Oh, no. I like it when the guests tell great stories and chat. It's wonderful.
It's been a real pleasure. And I think your show is a wonderful show from the perspective of just that. Folks need to learn that whatever they're doing, it's good enough. And you can strive for more, but be where you're at and focus. That's one lesson I've learned probably a little later in life than I should have.
We never know what the future has planned for us. So
Tomorrow's a gift.
That's right. Well, Victor, it's been quite enjoyable. Thank you for joining me on Background Mode.
Anytime.
If you would like to be contacted, if the listeners would like to touch bases with you, how can they do that?
Actually, you can go to victorcahiao.com, which is kind of goes to my old blog. I'm going to try to keep that up a little bit more as I'm starting some new musical stuff that we can talk about some other time.
All right, cool. All right, well, folks, you've been listening to Victor Cahiao on Background Mode. And thanks for joining us. It's been fun. And we'll see you again next week.